I'm Anna Sale, in today for Leonard Lopate. The gap between rich and poor is widening to an extent not seen since before the Great Depression. President Obama has called it the defining challenge of our time. But first, we need a thorough understanding of the economics of inequality. That's the project at the heart of the new book, Capital in the 21st Century, by Thomas Piketty. He's a scholar at the Paris School of Economics, and he's studied the dynamics of the distribution of wealth for some 20 years. His new book is getting the kind of reception that 700-page books on economics almost never do. The Belknap Press released the book ahead of schedule to meet demand. It's been called, quote, the definitive account of historical evolution of inequality, and his analysis has been compared to Tocqueville's and its sweep. I'm very pleased it brings Thomas Piketty to our show today. Welcome to the Leonard Lopate Show.
Thank you.
First, I want to say, reading this book, for being a 700-page book about economics, in its ambition, it's also a very comfortable read. You add in literary references, Jane Austen, Balzac, sprinkled amongst an analysis, so it feels quite grounded in the world we actually live in. But I want to start with what is actually driving your argument, and you look at data that other economists haven't. You look at data from a number of countries, the United States, France, Britain, India, Japan among them. What are you looking at that other economists have missed?
First of all, I should say that, you know, this book is my own book, but it really relies on a collective research project. So together with over 20 scholars from over 30 countries, you know, we have been collecting this data for the past 15 years. So, you know, I first did it for France, and with Tony Atkinson, we did it for Britain. With Emmanuel Saez, who's at Berkeley, we did it for the US. With Facundo Alvarendo for Argentina, Bijit Banerjee for India. So this is really a and I could never have done it on my own. Also, I could never have done it without the, you know, the information technologies of today. So, you know, the scholars of the 1950s or 1970s or even 1990s, you know, it was much more difficult for them to collect the kind of large volume of data in fiscal archives and estate records that we've been collecting. And you know, an additional reason maybe why this was not done before is that, you know, this subject somehow was too historical for economists and too economic for historians. So, you know, nobody was doing it because of, you know, these sharp boundaries between disciplines that we sometimes have in academia, and which I think are excessive because, you know, in the social sciences, you know, we should, you know, is this a book of history, a book of economics? You know, I don't really know and I don't really care. You know, I think we... there are questions, we should try to answer them. And finally, the other reason why this was not done before, I think, is that, yeah, we live in a time of where inequality is a concern. During a very long period of time, I think during the Cold War period and the post-war reconstruction period, this was a little bit of a forbidden subject because, well, partly because indeed things were going better. So, you know, there was a feeling that, you know, growth was widely distributed and growth was very fast. And also during the Cold War period, you know, people wanted to believe in sort of happy end about inequality and capitalism. And so, you know, if you had a fight on this issue, there was really this big political world fight going on between capitalism and communism. So, you know, I belong to a generation who didn't have to participate to this because I was not born or I was too young. And, you know, I turned 18 at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall. You know, I visited Eastern European countries and I was looking at the, you know, the fall of the communist dictatorship. And, you know, I think I belong to a generation that can reopen these debates about inequality in capitalist societies, you know, without being, you know, questioned about my intention. You know, I'm not going to defend the Soviet Union. You know, we are not at this stage yet. And, you know, yet we have inequalities that are in some ways returning to the kind of 19th century inequality structure that we thought we had made over with them in the post-war era. And so, yeah, it's time to reopen the entire file.
And as you reopen it, you come to something that's quite simple, which is a primary driver of inequality and looks at the rate of growth versus the rate of returns on capital. And when the rate of returns on existing capital exceed the rate of growth, you get exceeding inequality. Describe how that works.
Right. So it's a very simple law which summarizes a big part of my book, although there are other forces that play an important role. This inequality between R and G, the rate of return to capital and the growth rate, is sometimes comes as a surprise to some people who say, you know, how is it that the rate of return to capital can be permanently larger than the growth rate? Now, in fact, there's really no paradox at all. And the best way to see that is to first to look at the past. So, you know, it was obvious to everybody in traditional agrarian societies that R was bigger than G. You know, they would not formulate it this way, but, you know, the growth rate was 0%. So, you know, population was stagnating, productivity was stagnating or growing at 0.1% per year. So, growth was zero. And of course, the return to capital was positive. So, for instance, you know, if you open any novel by Jane Austen, you will see that the annual rent to a piece of property, for instance, of a piece of land, is typically 4-5% of the value of the land. So everybody knew at that time, you know, in 18th century Britain, everybody knew that if you want rent, an annual capital income of £1,000, you know, you should have a capital stock of £20,000, so that 5% of the capital will give you your annual income of £1,000. And it was so obvious to everybody that, you know, the novelists don't even need to make explicit this computation from the stock to the flow of income. You know, it's clear for everybody. And in a way, R bigger than G was even, you know, this was the very foundation of society, because this is what allowed a group of owners, typically land owners or owners of whatever assets, you know, public debt or other assets that there was to own, to live off their property and to do something else than their own, than to care about their own survival. So, you know, they can do literary activities, science, you know, political activities, whatever. Now, with the Industrial Revolution, the growth rate increased, but it did not increase up to the point where it will compensate, you know, for the rate of return. So it will increase to maybe 1-1.5% in 19th century industrial capitalism. And you know, the rate of return to capital was still, you know, 4-5%, or maybe sometime even a bit more on the new form of industrial capital, 6-7% sometime. So the gap between R and G, you know, did not really reduce. And because there was such this large gap, the concentration of wealth remained very large. So, mm-hmm. you know, the striking discovery is that the nature of wealth and the nature of capital, of course, has transformed completely. You know, in 1900, 1910, land does not matter anymore. You know, in Downton Abbey, you have the feeling that land is still everything. But in fact, it's only in the series. You know, in the real life, in 1910 Britain, you know, land is less than 5% of national wealth. And in France also, it's less than 5% of national wealth. And what matters is already financial capital, you know, stock market shares, real estate. And the concentration of these new forms of wealth is just as high or even higher than the concentration of land in the 18th century. And the only thing that made this change during the 20th century was really a combination of very unusual events. And, you know, primarily World War I, the Great Depression, World War II, which reduced the return to private capital to very low level because of destructions, inflation, taxation. And then in the post-war period, we have unusually large growth rate, partly because of reconstruction, of recovery, partly also because of a more positive reason, which is a very large population growth, you know, the baby boom cohorts and, you know, the demographic transition. So it's important to realize that this purely demographic aspect of growth, you know, plays a big role in my book, and plays a big role, you know, certainly in this country. You know, in the U.S., we are accustomed to perpetual population growth, you know, population of 3 million at the time of independence, 100 million in 1900, 300 million today. You know, are we going to be in the U.S. 900 million one century from now? You know, maybe not. Maybe yes. But in any case, whatever happened will have a very big importance on the total growth rate of the economy, and therefore on the comparison between the rate of return and the growth rate. and therefore on the long-term concentration of wealth. And if we have, to the extent that we will have a growth slowdown, and in particular population growth slowdown pretty much everywhere, and we've already seen that in the past few decades, with also the slowdown of post-war growth due to the reconstruction period, the gap between the rate of return and the growth rate, you know, has been rising over the past 20 to 30 years. And I believe this partly explains, there are other forces as well, but this partly explains the rise in wealth concentration. And this could well continue in the future.
So you say wealth concentration. The other way people talk about it is wealth inequality and inequality, economic inequality. There's a striking graph in the first pages of your book on page 24 in the introduction, where you see that in the U.S. 20th century, you see that peak. It looks a bit like a rough U, the peak just before 1929 of broad wealth inequality. And then you see in 1945, it looks like a dip, and it's basically a U, a plateau. And then that changes in 1980. How should we understand, if there's a public interest in growing and expanding the benefits of capitalism so that there's widespread growth, lots of people benefit, and we don't want to have a world war, mm-hmm. what do we look to?
Oh, there are many other ways and much better ways to have a more equitable distribution of growth and of income and wealth than wars, of course. So, you know, in this country, the wars were much less, important. You know, of course, there was no destruction on U.S. soil as compared to Europe. So, you know, the political reaction to that, that were more important in a way. You know, the policy changes. So some of them were induced by the war, but, you know, some of them were induced, particularly in the U.S., by the political process itself. So, you know, it is true that in Europe, for instance, you know, in France, you know, the elite refused the income tax until World War One, and it's only, in fact, to finance the war, to pay for the war, that the income tax was created. It was not to pay for schools. It was not to reduce, consumption tax paid by the working class. It was to pay for the war, and that's very sad. And certainly also in the 1920s, you know, the fact that there was a Bolshevik Revolution, you know, made the elite changed their mind about progressive taxation.
A response to a threat.
Yes, they thought, after all, you know, progressive taxation. So in Europe, it is true that these shocks played a very large role. In the U.S., you know, I have a more optimistic reading of history. You know, I think the political process itself, you know, the democratic institution sort of responded by really inventing institutional responses, you know, including very sharply progressive taxation of income and inherited wealth, which was really invented, you know, right here in the United States of America. And this is something that we forget, but, you know, this was invented in the 1920s, 30s in the U.S. And you've never had, you know, in Europe, the progressivity of the income tax system has never been as large as in the U.S., where, you know, between 1930 and 1980, on average, the top rate of the federal income tax is 82%. And, you know, this did not kill American capitalism, apparently. And in fact, there was more growth in the 50s, 60s, 70s than there's been since 1980. And the reason is because this very top tax rate applied only to enormously high incomes, you know, above the equivalent of $1 or $2 million today. So this would not apply to, you know, anybody making $100,000 or $200,000. It would apply to really very, very high incomes, which, you know, from the evidence that we have, are not really useful for growth. You know, it's not, you know, you don't need to pay managers 100 times or 200 times average wages to make them work. You know, this is just wrong. I mean, it could be right, but, you know, when we look at the evidence, we look at the gross performance of, you know, companies paying their managers $10 more million per year. You don't see this extra growth and this extra performance that some people pretend you get.
So I want to just underscore that point. What you are saying, you take some time to look at what is behind the increase in compensation for top managers. You're just making the point that the argument that those job creators, as they're sometimes called in the political debate, when they have more wealth, that's not necessarily trickling down.
No, beyond the point, it's not. You know, you need some inequality, you know, to put incentives of people. But beyond a certain point, you know, you don't get extra performance. You know, it's when you compare the performance of different companies, you know, offering different packages to their managers. When you compare the performance of the U.S. economy to other countries like, you know, Germany or Sweden, and you compare the productivity growth over the past 20 to 30 years, you know, in the U.S., you have rising inequality everywhere except in the growth statistics, you know. So the growth performance of the past 20 to 30 years has not been terribly good. You know, per capita GDP growth has been 1.5%. So if you get two-thirds or three-quarters of that growth going to the top 1%, you know, it's not a good deal for the rest of the population. You know, if the growth rate had been, you know, 3, 4, 5%, then, you know, you could make the case that this is worth it. But here it's not worth it. You know, this is not a useful inequality. This is just excessive. And you know, I think in this case, there is an easy way to get around it, which is a return to, you know, steeply progressive tax rate at the very top of the income distribution. For the dynamics of wealth concentration, this is more complicated. We also need new forms of policies and including progressive taxation of net wealth as opposed to progressive taxation of income. And that's a more novel challenge for the future.
That gets to inheritance.
That gets to inheritance, but here I'm also talking of an annual tax on net wealth and not only taxation at the time of inheritance. So I'm more thinking in terms of what's come closest to what I have in mind will be the property tax, which is an annual tax you pay on your property, except that the existing property tax in the U.S. is not progressive. It's proportional. It doesn't take into account financial assets, and it doesn't take into account financial debt. So it will make a big difference. So, for instance, you know, if we were to take the property tax as it exists now and keep the same tax revenue, but transform it in a progressive tax on net wealth, you know, that would imply that, you know, the bottom 90% of the population will pay less tax. And, you know, the top wealth people will pay more tax. So if you take, an average American family or, you know, a bit above average that will have, a house worth $500,000 and if they have a mortgage of $490,000, you know, they are not rich. You know, their net wealth, in my sense, you know, will be $10,000. So they will pay basically no tax with a progressive tax on net wealth. Whereas right now, you know, they pay as much property tax as someone who's with no mortgage. And, you know, sometimes you even have people whose property value has fallen below their mortgage, who have a negative net wealth, and they keep paying, you know, the same property tax. And at the other extreme, you have people who have, billions in net wealth, but who are only paying property tax on their real estate property, which is a tiny part of their net wealth. So I think, you know, this property tax system comes from the 19th century, when property was real estate property. You know, now we have a lot of financial wealth, we have a lot of also financial debt, and we need, a taxation system that is adequate for this 21st century capitalism.
That updates the definition of property, you're saying.
Yeah.
One point that you make in the book that I think is interesting is the distinction between human capital and industrial capital, because there's so much talk about human capital as a road to growth. You make the argument that that doesn't need to be updated, that the real power still lies in industrial capital, even in the 21st century.
Well, both are important. Look, education, human capital is important, and, you know, better access to higher education in this country and in Europe, you know, is key for future growth and for reduction inequality. I'm just saying that we should also care about, you know, financial capital, business capital, because the concentration of this other form of capital is always more extreme, you know, more unequal than the distribution of labor skills and labor income. And maybe also in the post-war period, you know, we had some hope that somehow only human capital matters and that, you know, this is the end of financial capital and real estate capital and the kind of large wealth holdings, you know, that was gone and that belongs only to the past and to sort of pre-World War I societies and, you know, Titanic and, you know, a world that has gone. But it didn't, you know, it hasn't gone as much as we hope.
That's not true, is what the main argument your book makes, I would say. Janet asks, is there a country with a wealth tax, with an example of what of the kind of thing you're talking about?
Well, the U.S. has a property tax that is a wealth tax. So most countries have wealth tax of this kind. I think no country has a right wealth tax that I would recommend, because most countries, you know, would have their property tax system, you know, rooted in the 19th mm-hmm. century, in fact. And so, you know, this is a challenge for the future, and certainly, you know, this requires international cooperation. So, in particular, the talk that we've had, that we've been having these past few years about tax havens, you know, that's very much related to that. You know, you need to have more global cooperation. You need to have a global registry of financial assets. You know, many people say this will never happen. But, you know, 5 years ago, people say that Swiss banks will never break their bank secrecy laws. And, you know, with the pressures actually of the United States and, you know, pressure on Swiss banks, you know, this happens. So, you know, things can change much more quickly than we sometimes believe.
So read the book now, because the 21st century will continue. Thomas Piketty is the author of Capital in the 21st Century. It's a great book. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
It.